Hello and welcome to Out of Office. I'm your host, Malika Kapoor. Our guest today is candid. He confesses that when he first stepped into the world of finance, he had no idea what mutual funds were. He also recognizes that his pattern of mistakes can be boiled down to one word, indecisiveness. He's Sandro Pieri, the CEO of BNP Paribas Asset Management, which oversees over half a trillion euros. Pieri grew up in a small Italian village. He says his childhood was pretty ordinary. He played sports, studies, was surrounded by family and friends, and he had absolutely no interest in finance. After studying economics at the University of Torino, he got a job as an equity analyst, and the rest is, well, history. Pieri says he's been fortunate enough to have people taking bets on him early on in his career, and now he wants to do the same for the younger generation rising up. In this episode of Out of Office, Pieri talks to my colleague Yajo San about his career trajectory, what he's learned from his share of mistakes, how generative AI will disrupt the asset management business, and the four factors causing a paradigm shift in the world we live in. Here's their conversation.
Sandro, welcome to Out of Office. We're so excited to have you here. We are living in very turbulent times. The war in Ukraine is still going on. Central bankers around the world are battling inflation while trying to limit the credit crunch. We're having unprecedented banking turmoil in the US and also in Europe. And now there's a wave of ESG backlash in the US, and maybe it will spread to Europe. We'll see. I'm very excited to dive into all of that with you. But first, I am hoping that you can share with our listeners a little bit about your childhood. Where'd you grow up and how would you describe your upbringing?
Okay, so first, thanks a lot for having me in this podcast. And it's a pleasure to be with you and all the listeners. I actually grew up in a little village in the north of Italy, somewhat closer to the French border, so in the Piedmont region, so close to Torino. Yep. That's actually where I grew up and studied. And I had a very normal childhood. I mean, like everyone, sports, studying, family and friends, and nothing special. And at that time, I had no idea what finance was. So I graduated in economics at the University of Torino. But actually, I didn't have really a particular interest in finance. And just to be completely transparent, I also didn't know what mutual funds were at that time. So, So it was by a series of coincidence that when I graduated, I actually, after a few months, at the time it was called PricewaterhouseCoopers and Lybrand. So the in a way, the accounting consulting firms. I got a call from one of the new emerging asset management company in the Italian industry. Italy has been somewhat lagging in terms of mutual fund development, some of the Anglo-Saxon countries. And I got a call to basically become an equity analyst. And I hardly knew what that was at that time. Mm-hmm. I took it from there and I really enjoyed from the very beginning, and that's where the whole story started. So I started as an equity analyst, and then I moved into managing portfolios. Actually, I've been managing predominantly US equities, and I have a couple of years running European equities. Mm-hmm. And what I liked about asset management at that time was that it was really bringing together some of the interests that I, in a way, I've always cultivated, because early days, I had an interest in policy making and philosophy, which is something I keep having as a passion. I like maths and statistics. And I think asset management and especially portfolio management helped me to basically put all this stuff at work. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, in a way how I started. So that's as much for the beginning. And then, you know, it has been a bit of a long story. I turned 59, so it's been quite some time that has passed by.
I want to ask, you know, I actually studied economics in college as well. And looking back, I can't help but feeling that economics is really a social science kind of masquerading as a hard science. Would you agree with that? How do you
totally.
Think? Yeah.
Absolutely, totally. I think that in my view, there's a misconception about economic being an art science. I mean, there's a, and I think with the recent development that we have seen in economics, you know, with the rise of behavioral economics, I think what you just said, I think has been proven to be even more real. So I think it's really, in a way, which also applies to market, is not only modeling stuff, but understanding animal spirits, which makes a difference. And I think that applies to economics and finance as well. So completely agree with you.
Yes, people are not always rational. We need to remember that.
Exactly.
So you said you landed your first job as a US equity manager. That was for São Paulo funds.
Yeah.
How did you do that? Was it like a really easy jump off point after college?
Well, look, I started as an equity analyst for a while, and then a position opened up, and I started as a junior portfolio manager, and I just enjoyed it. And I think, in a way, again, as I said, what I liked was the multidisciplinary element of being a portfolio manager. I realized that, again, you need to understand accounting, you need to understand strategy. But I think one of the things that they started to be to resonate with me as I started to meet a number of companies and management of the different companies that we were investing on, was that the leadership element was a key element in translating a good ideas into something concrete and with value. So I started to develop a bit of an interest at that time also on all this leadership element, which actually at that time I didn't realize they would have been very valuable in the future, but I think it's. I can now give a bit of sense of what I've done, why I focus on the leadership side, even when I was a portfolio management, because I think that has helped me quite a bit during my career development.
If someone were to describe your leadership style, what do you think they would say?
Oh, look, I think there's a couple of elements which are I believe important, and probably most of the people that have worked with me or for me would probably recognize. The first is that trust is important to me. So in any organization, but I would say in any, even within family, trust-based relationship is key. I've always built my career trying to be a trustable person for my bosses at that time. And this is exactly what I'm looking when we're building teams. Trust is crucial because when you're running a large organization, you need to put processes and control in place. But there's nothing that replaces a trust-based culture. Because at the end of the day, you have teams operating like 10,000 miles away. And with all the processes that you can put in place, you need to trust them that they will be aligned in terms of value, which implies that they would always try to do the right thing. Doesn't mean that they will always be right, but they will. You need to get that level of comfort. So trust, I would say, it's an important element. The second element is I give disproportionate attention to people. And of course, everyone knows that asset management is a people-based business, and there's no make no mistake. This is absolutely the case. Mm-hmm. But for me, this is also it is not only to do with the nature of the business, but it's also to do with my own nature in a way. And I reflected upon it, and I've been lucky enough in my career to always find people that took an early bet on me. So they gave me trust, and they actually offered me a chances to progress in my career. Even when I was very young and maybe inexperienced, people took a bet on me. And this element of trust, people development, is probably a constant throughout my career, which I think is inspiring me in my day-to-day leadership job.
So because there are certainly people who subscribe to the philosophy of not backing a lame duck, but you believe it's important to give people opportunities for them to flourish.
Yeah, if you don't take risk on people, you'll never know whether the potential is real. So you need, we all need to take more risk with people when we see potential. And of course, you need to be ready to live with mistakes. You made me say that's normal. No? There's nothing wrong with it.
Well, speaking of mistakes, I was wondering if you made, are there any career blunders perhaps that you can share with us?
No, look, I've made tons of mistakes and I keep doing mistakes. So that's a constant in life. And by the way, I think it's important that everyone, not only in our businesses, in our business, but I would say overall in economic activity, needs to be to learn to live with mistakes. There's nothing wrong. I mean, it's a law of nature, and that's also how we learn. Now, mistakes. I would say, look, I don't have anything specific in mind, but I can definitely see a pattern in a number of mistakes that I made. And one of the patterns is that when I waited too much to make a decision, which goes back again to the point I'm making that at the end of the day, we also need to take risk in making decision. So one of the patterns is that in a number of cases, a number of mistakes I've made were, you know, we're behind, there were probably a level of indecisiveness on my end of not having enough conviction, and then waited too long. And then when you make that decision, then it turns out to be a mistake. So timing is an important element in the decision-making, because something that might be right today, if you wait too long, it might become wrong. And this element of timing, you know, it's something that I've learned in my portfolio management career. I mean, if you like a company and you're just waiting for the long term, but you're just waiting for something to happen, that might not happen. And then it's you might miss an opportunity, or when you jump on the bandwagon, it might be too late. So I think this is probably one of the patterns where I made many mistakes. I've tried to correct that. I think I'm now at the point in which a bit based on experience, a bit based on the trust that I have on the team around me, I tend to be quite decisive when, you know, without being over analytical in making decisions.
So now you go with your intuition.
No, look, again, don't take me wrong. Intuition is an element, is a bit of experience, but there's a good preparation to that. The point is that, as everyone would probably agree, the marginal utility of doing the 20-30% extra analytical work doesn't bring a lot of value in decision making. So if you stop at 70% and you need to do a proper work for the 70 or 80%, then you're in a good position to take decision.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
You know, we'll have to bring up what happened with Credit Suisse and UBS. I'm just, you know, very curious. How do you think that would affect the competitive landscape of asset management and wealth management in Europe?
Look, our industry is an industry which is still quite fragmented. I mean, not only in Europe, I would say globally. I think if you take the top three firms, they probably represent 20-25% of the overall, let's say, market share of the overall industry. And if you compare it to, again, the first industry that comes to my mind is probably auto manufacturing. I guess that the top three or would probably control 80 or 90% of the market. So that gives you a sense of the level of fragmentation that is still exists in our industry. Now, having said that, there's a couple of reasons why this is not progressing. One is that, frankly, our industry has been enjoying a very nice ride over the last 20 years. Asset growth fueled by, you know, asset gathering, but also by market appreciation. Reasonably stable margin, and with a cost base which is predominantly fixed, that has resulted in significant improvement on profit growth and in a way, I think we have enjoyed very nice margins. So the pressures to scale has been somewhat less pronounced than in many other industries. The second element is that this is the nature of our industry, and we have touched upon before. It's a people-based industry, and at the end of the day, you can put together two companies, but people need to make sure that there's a full cultural alignment and value alignment, because otherwise people would walk away. So the fact that it's a people-based business, I think, is also, in my view, a bit of a structural reason why consolidation doesn't happen at the same pace that we're seeing in other industry as well. We took a deliberate and conscious decision to put sustainability at the core of what we do. So for us, this is, I would say, part of our DNA. So being what we call the sustainable investor for a changing world, recognize that our role is a role where we help clients and investors to achieve their goal by using the impact that sustainability will have on asset prices going forward. Mm. I would even go one step farther and saying that, look, the reality is that I think we're living at a moment of which is quite unprecedented. In my view, there are four major disruptions happening at the same time, one being sustainability, the other being technology, the third being demographics, and the fourth being geopolitics. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to expand if needed. But the point is that this element of changing world is around sustainability, but is the fact that we're probably going to see a number of paradigm shifts. And that's, I think, our DNA. I think for us, this is not about a product, but it's mm-hmm. really about who we want to be.
I have to say, though, critics have said that ESG has become a box-ticking exercise. And I think you have to agree, you know, especially with the news of Verra, the largest carbon offset market, you know, now proven to be, mostly fake and actually bad for the environment. Would you say that perhaps the market has seen too many products, ESG products, in the last 5 years or so? And how do you see this going forward?
Look, my view is that there's some truth to what you said, and I think to me it has to do with the fact that when a number of firms realized that actually that was the new hot trend in the market, they just put themselves a lot of money to basically be positioned in the sustainability field. From our angle, we started earlier, and we haven't changed our course over the last year and a half, where, you know, probably sustainability has been somewhat challenged. The real line of divide is those who are really, you know, putting sustainability as a cultural element and with a strong belief that actually, given the disruption that we're observing, this will have a meaningful impact on asset prices. And those who are doing it just because they need to ride the last wave of product. And the jury is going to be out on those who are between those who are doing it seriously and those who are doing it maybe just more cyclic in a more cyclical way, if you see what I'm saying.
Yes. Speaking of hot trends, I think you'll have to agree that generative AI is really wowing consumers and investors alike. Have you given this technology a thought about, you know, how maybe it will impact your industry? Would this ultimately lead to a slimmer and sharper workforce, perhaps? And how does that impact the kind of talent that you look for?
So maybe I'll start from the talent. So it's very clear that, any asset manager, but I would say any company in almost any sector they seriously need to look at the impact that technology will have on their business model, operating model, cost structure, and so on and so forth. So that applies to us as well. And one of the problems that I think as an industry you have is that we are not necessarily the natural employers for the young tech people coming out of some of the leading universities. They would typically go work for some of the unicorn or some of the large tech companies or some of the startups, but not necessarily for someone in finance. So the first challenge that we have is attract people in the tech space because we need to build way more skill set than we have right now as an industry. At the same time, and to be honest, I mean, that's the challenge. I think on our side, what we're trying to do is not only keep hiring that kind of profile, but also trying to build a bit of an ecosystem whereby we have exposure to young fintech, either commercially or through equity stakes, because we are, you know, at least from my side, I'm taking a view that it's going to be very difficult to develop everything internally. We're never going to be able to keep all the competencies. So this dual model of having young talent and creating an ecosystem where we're exposed to what happens, I think is the way forward on tech in general. Now, on how this is going to transform the business, look, there's three dimensions to it, in my view. The first one is operational efficiency. And this is probably where we are a bit more advanced on leveraging everything that we've seen over the last three, five years as an industry. I think there's a number of areas where automation will play a role, where use of AI and machine learning techniques will play a role. For example, on our side, we're using NPL and machine learnings to do portfolio performance commentaries. Mm-hmm. So it's real, it's live, and it's very efficient. There's a second element, which is how technology will transform and change customer journey, which has to do with, you know, not only digital interaction, and this is happening, but whether this would have an impact on the distribution pattern. So today is mostly physical and intermediated by the traditional channel. My view is that this is not going to change for quite some time, but the digital customer experience will go through significant changes that will affect both asset and wealth management. And the third dimension is of technology is going to be whether we can use intelligently all sets of data to help us generate alpha in our core business. So how we can make better use of all the information available. Mm. This is probably relatively new. We're experimenting. So we're working on it, but it's a bit early days. And to me, these are the three areas in which we're looking at technology from our side.
What keeps you up at night? What keeps you worried?
Oof, normally I sleep quite
pretty
well.
Oh, see, that's a challenge.
No, but look, joking aside, look, the as I told you, I wouldn't say a concern, but one of the topic I'm spending quite a bit of time thinking about it is what would be the implication of these four major disruptions happening at the same time. Because I frankly don't remember in my career life such a period where there's a real paradigm shift. I mean, we have lived in an era of globalization. Mm-hmm. And now I think with the geopolitical development, we're not going to see globalization the way we have experienced so far. Technology, we have discussed it, sustainability, is probably the biggest shift in capital allocation that our generation will observe, and I would say probably in the whole history of economy. And then demographics, I think, will probably generate significant impact in terms of stock and flows of assets, expected return from the different asset class. So how this will all come together and the impact on our industries, it's what I would call uncharted territories. And I'm trying to force myself not to use the same toolkit that has served us so well over the last 20 years to assess the future. Because typically, in a moment of paradigm shift, you tend to use the toolkit that you've used in the different paradigms, and that are not probably that helpful. So again, it doesn't keep me awake at night, but it's probably one of the most constant thinking I have in terms of defining the positioning and the strategy of the firm for the next 5 to 10 years.
Which city do you think is going to be Europe's financial center in 5 years?
Of course, Paris.
You seem very long Paris. I look forward to checking in with you on that. Last question. At this stage of your career, what drives you?
Well, that's what I kind of keep asking myself almost every day. Look, to me, there's a few things. The first one is that I like to have an impact on people's life. This has been a bit of the constant in my career. So I really enjoy shaping the firm for the future, finding talents, bringing talents to the next level, and get the most out of the human capital that we have in the firm. That I would say is probably my biggest drive and my biggest motivation at this stage. And if I have to think like, one day I will leave, retire, and if I would have to think back of, what I would be proud of, I think if at the end of the day, the company I've been leading would be one of the employer of choice and would be top of mind for the clients, that is what I would consider a success. And to me personally, the fact that I'm still in, I still have strong relationship with a number of people that I work with and I work for, or that have worked for me over the past 25 years, that's rewarding. So it's really, again, the human side, which I think is my driving force at this stage.
Making positive impacts on people's lives. It's a very noble cause for everyone. Thank you so much. This is a really enlightening conversation. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was my colleague Yajo San in conversation with BNP Paribas' Sandro Pieri. I hope you enjoyed that chat. I know that I did. This episode was produced by Yang Yang. I'm Malika Kapoor. Thank you for listening to Out of Office.